Welcome to the Dark Mind Podcast. Friends and familiars, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Dark Mind Podcast, where we explore the boundless realm of dark literature and film. On today's show, we have a writer of dark, boundary-pushing horror. His visceral, unapologetic style has earned him the prestigious Splatterpunk Award, along with 3 nominations. He's joining me today to talk about his new novel entitled Through the Eyes of Desperation, The Red Version. So without further ado, join me as we delve into the dark insight of Aaron Beauregard. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be back. Glad to see the show still going strong. Thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining me on this 13th day of March 2024. I came across the announcement for the release of your new book entitled Through the Eyes of Desperation, The Red Version, on your Instagram page, and was really looking forward to seeing what you had in store for your readers. And as always, it was a story fraught with emotional agony, addiction, violence, depravity, as well as the ability to choose between 2 separate endings. So I really enjoyed it, and I appreciate you being on the show today.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, very excited to release the book, kind of try to do something a little bit different with this one. I appreciate you reading and anybody else who gave it a shot. I'm looking forward to talking about it. Thank you.
Yes, and I extra appreciate you being on the show today, because I know you have been burning the midnight oil, working into the wee hours of the morning, trying to get those hardbacks out to the customers. So I appreciate you muscling through that.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure. It's unpredictable, I guess, with, you know, any kind of production stuff, so.
Gotcha. Well, the book is about a man named Patrick Blanchfield, nicknamed Red, who finds himself playing a very dangerous game with equally dangerous people. He was initially driven by the urgent need for money to pay a private investigator to find his daughter, who was taken by his drug-addicted and dangerous ex-girlfriend. However, now he has to save his mother as well as himself. So the main theme of the story is desperation driving people to do very dangerous, self-destructive things to get what they want and/or need. Red has experience with addiction being the source of desperation, but after getting cleaned up, it's now the much more honorable goal of finding his daughter. So how does his history with addiction influence his thoughts and actions when it comes to the search for his daughter?
Well, I think that's the thing with addiction, right? It's like that demon's always sort of waiting, you know, around every corner. We're never fully healed from addiction, I don't think. And, you know, most addicts will tell you that you got to kind of remain conscious, or recovering addicts, I should say. You got to kind of remain conscious that it's always there. So what would you do to try and do the right thing? Would you kind of go back down a path that could lead you, you know, back into the things that got you in trouble in the first place, kind of, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that's interesting about the Red character is he's sort of battling with wondering if the child's actually his, you know? So that's kind of an internal struggle for that character, but I hope that answers the question.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's one thing I wasn't sure if I should bring up or not, was the fact that he struggles as to whether or not it is actually his kid. It's this strange dynamic, because it's almost like he can't quite decide whether the lack of a biological tie should change his mind or not, because he did develop a bond with this child, because, you know, while his ex was, you know, just doing the crazy shit that she did, he was kind of, in a sense, trying to shield her as best he could, even though he himself was kind of enmeshed in active addiction.
Yeah. And, you know, I was someone who my life was very much impacted by my stepfather, you know. So the message is, well, I don't want to say that this is the message, but one's left to ponder as they read, I think. Also, an important question of, you know, does it really matter? You know, like, can you have the same connection to somebody that you would almost like a family member? Because obviously, you know, we can't pick our family, but we could pick our friends, of course.
Yeah. Well, when Red is in the throes of addiction with the mother of his child, Brittany, or purported mother of his child, Brittany, he's more of a passive player, just kind of hanging on to get high and have sex with Brittany, who at the time he finds very attractive. However, it turns out that Brittany is whoring herself out and is as cold-blooded as it gets when it comes to getting what she wants, without getting into spoiler details. So even though Red was high all the time, as I alluded to just now, he did his best to try and protect his daughter, Desi, from the dangerous elements that their lives entailed. So if Desi hadn't been taken by Brittany, would Red have gotten sober in order to do what's best for her? Or would he have just continued to stew in addiction? And can you expand on the motivation behind his decision to clean up?
Yeah, you know, I think that's an interesting thing, right? Like, sometimes it's the hard moments in life. It's the pressure that creates the diamond, right? Like, the difficult moments that push us forward and can bring us down a path of redemption potentially. But as I said, you know, a little bit earlier, it's a double-edged sword too, because you have to be strong to, you know, retrace those steps without error. So I think there is something to that, you know, because it's an element of guilt, you know, when a problem leaves your life, it releases all this stress. But in the back of your mind, you're still like, is it fucked up that I'm just acting like it's nothing, you know? Because, yeah, I think that's something that I've had to deal with. I think that's something that, you know, a lot of people have to deal with at different stretches of their lives, you know? So it's an interesting thing to kind of play with.
Well, once it is discovered that Red has unintentionally stolen a large sum of money from very dangerous people, as a last-ditch effort to retrieve the money from him, he is sent to an underground casino, literally underground, called Shadows, with the intention being that he will either win enough money to pay his debtors back or suffer a heinous death. And casinos in general are meant to be immersive worlds. They don't have windows or clocks, so you can't keep track of time. They just want you to keep gambling, and the activity goes on 24 hours a day. So what was your process for constructing the world of Shadows Casino, particularly regarding the layout?
Well, without going into too much detail, I think part of it is I didn't want to just blow people out of the water right when they walk in. I wanted it to be fucked up. And from an architectural standpoint of Shadows, there is a thought process behind that and why. It's not just because we want to build in storytelling. It's actually like from a character, the one that this guy Gianni, who actually is responsible for creating Shadows. And the idea is that these sort of entry-level tables, a lot of them are based in humiliation and degradation of the human spirit, kind of. So sort of breaking these people down, almost preparing them for the worst things that lie within the tunnel walls of the Shadows Casino. And I wanted to take at least some of the major staple casino games and put a really disturbing twist on them. And then maybe some that aren't as popular, you know, also kind of just some curveballs in there, just so that the reader really knows we could really go anywhere with this. Anything could happen, you know. And, you know, of course, as it goes on, it just keeps getting worse. So, but yeah, it was a fun world to build. Honestly, like I could have even written more about it. It's a long book. It's novel length, but it's just such a fun thing. I don't know. So I had a great time with it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, I don't think the combination of the different rooms, like the main floor and such, equaled to eight, but it's almost kind of like the eight circles of hell or the, what was it in Dante? Was it eight circles of hell?
Oh, right, right. I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah.
And we wanted to, like, I was like, oh, what else are casinos known for? You know, and it's obviously there's that showman mentality, I guess, right? Like shows, whether it be comedy shows, magic shows, like, there's always something going on at a casino too. So that's why I thought, obviously we have like the main floor and the main floor is broken down into many sections of different games. Mm-hmm. Then there's like the entry tables. Then there is the theater, which is where any kind of entertainment would be happening. And then there's the dollhouse, which is where kind of like lust comes into play. And of course, you know, obviously what casino isn't complete without the buffet, you know?
The buffet, yes. Definitely dug the buffet.
Yeah. That's going to test everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, once Red is in the casino, he realizes, as you alluded to, that the games are similar to traditional casino games, but are played a little differently. You can use your own money, or you can use house credit, but house credit is basically using your body as collateral. And mixing gambling with bodily harm or death is an intense combination and is probably no better illustrated than the game of Russian roulette. There is no Russian roulette in this book because the games you come up with are far more creative. So how did you approach constructing these insane games? You mentioned you wanted to have some of the staple games involved. If it won't cause a spoiler, could you tell us which one was your favorite and why? Like, you don't have to get into the details of how the game operates, but maybe just name the game that was possibly your favorite. And if it won't create a spoiler, maybe tell us why.
Sure. There was a couple that weren't originally in the book, and I went back and like added certain things because when I had completed the book, I was like, you know what? I need Red to gamble more in this book because Red comes in with, not to spoil anything, I don't think it's that big of a spoiler, but obviously he's coming in because he needs money, you know? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to do a little something more though after I had finished. And I added the blackjack scene. Like that wasn't originally in it. And like the character of Lane and all that, those are all added after the fact. And I just really like the atmosphere of the blackjack area too. Like it's very creepy. There's almost like a slasher movie vibe going on in that area. Yeah, I won't get too into exactly what happens with the blackjack stuff, but I would probably say that one. Yeah.
Yeah. Who was it that was like, stay away from the blackjack tables?
Yeah. Mr. Don. Yeah.
Mr. Don. Yeah.
Yeah. And who do you trust? You have all these weird casino-y characters, like some people who are like, Mr. Don is like, you know, scar-free and living his best life in there. And you're like, man, he's got to give good advice, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, unless he's outright lying, he knows what he's doing because he seemed to be one of the few people in One Piece in that place. Well, in order to facilitate the patrons of the casino getting into a headspace more conducive to violence and risk-taking, the casino provides a smorgasbord of every mind-altering substance known to man. And this was an ingenious story element, not only because it throws gas on the fire of the emotions of the gamblers, but also because Red had overcome issues with addiction. And based on his emotional disposition, was putting this amount of emotional stress on him necessary to make his engaging in these horrific games believable? And could you also expand on Red's emotional disposition when he's sober versus not?
I think so, because particularly, like, I'm not going to give anything away. I'm just going to say the latter part of the mystery parlay, I don't think sober Red does those things, you know?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, you need something extra to get there. And he has mind-altering substances. So I think, yeah, it was a very important vehicle. And again, you know, that's just the nature of sort of like casinos and gambling. It's like a real party kind of thing. And if that's something you've tried to get away from and you're trying to stay straight, I just find that battle fascinating because, you know, even if people are reading it and they, you know, they can't relate to it on that level, everybody can in some way, whether it's food or technology. Like there's all these addictions that we're kind of all constantly struggling with. So I think it's always a relevant topic. And I'm sorry, what was the second part of the question?
Oh, I mean, you answered the question as, you know, yeah, it probably wouldn't be believable that he could go to those extremes if he wasn't under the influence of something mind altering. But what was Red's disposition sober versus not sober?
Oh, right, right. Yeah, you know, I think like unsober Red, he's more of a follower, you know, and sober Red is a leader. You know, I think like if I'm just breaking it down at a very high level and not getting too granular, you know, and I think that can be true of a lot of people. You know, once you fall under the influence, you know, a lot of times you're more malleable. Like you look at the Manson family, shit like that, you know, like Charles Manson's drugging them all out so that he can manipulate them. You know, that's what happens with drugs. MK Ultra, right?
Yeah.
There's instances of this all throughout history, really. And yeah, when you get your shit together, you have a better feel for who you are and like what things in life really matter. Like the clouds start to kind of clear up. And it's interesting to see. And that's why we have early parts in the book where we see how Red kind of was as an addict and then how he was when he was straightened out. And then, you know, what happens when temptation's dangled in front of you again?
Yeah. Well, like with a lot of stories, Red has somewhat of a female love interest in the story, a woman by the name of Lily. He witnesses her trying to help someone, only to have that same person do something vile to her. And she seemed very out of place in the casino. You kind of give like a little bit about her, but what would be her backstory and how did she maintain her soul while existing in such an environment?
Well, this is one thing we haven't really talked about yet. There is actually a second book written by Daniel J. Volpe that is called Through the Eyes of Desperation, the Black Version. Now, my book is Through the Eyes of the Degenerate Gambler, Patrick Blanchfield, a.k.a. Red. The person who runs the casino is referred to as the Black Widow. And Daniel's book takes place over the simultaneous timeline, and it is all through the eyes of the Black Widow. It's a completely different story, but there are there's overarching moments within the story. So you'll get a couple pages that are actually like verbatim conversations, but the majority of the book's completely different. And then it's like, the conversations are through that other person's perspective. Now, the reason why I kind of like won't speak on Lily so much is because more of her story is revealed in the Black version.
Gotcha. See, I didn't realize. I just thought maybe the Black version was another degenerate gambler. I didn't realize it was actually the Black Widow's POV.
It is. And like, so Red makes appearances in that book. And so, I mean, you might have this in a later question, but we talked about the endings. There's two different endings for my book that the reader has to gamble on. And then for the Black version, there's two completely other different endings that the reader has to gamble on.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, there were two types of people in the casino. Those like Red who were in debt and forced to play to recoup their money or die trying, and those who were gambling addicts that were so desensitized that this was the only way to get a thrill. And it reminded me of the way porn addicts need more and more taboo, hardcore stuff because the vanilla stuff doesn't do it for them anymore. So, in a sense, some were desperate to stay alive and some were desperate to feel alive. So how did you approach the interaction between these two character types to increase the horror of the story?
Well, I wanted to kind of like show different sides to everything if I can, you know, like I always like to show the different vantage points, so to speak. And I think with this, It's like there's one character in particular that kind of really is the epitome of that, you know, adrenaline junkie. And he's sort of like,
I love that guy.
He's so ridiculous, right? He's so over the top.
I love him.
And again, if you like that guy, you see one little thing of him that you don't in my book in the black version, kind of like something's alluded to in my book about, he's just referred to as the bald man.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's interesting because Red sees this guy, and I think without saying it, he kind of sees maybe some of himself in the past when he was like on the streets hustling, stuff like that, you know, or in the present, really, because he's kind of forced back into that.
Well, some of the consequences for losing with house money were violent, while others were just kind of gross. And you kind of mentioned earlier about the entry table's intention was to kind of just break them down, like crush their egos, demoralize them. How did you determine the ratio of gross to violent experiences that Red would need to undergo to properly move the story forward as far as his character development or character devolvement, I guess I would be more appropriate?
Well, I'm kind of known for going gross and not being afraid. So my readers have certain expectations, but at the same time, I'm not going to just put something in there to put it in there. You know, I wanted to make it so like it made sense. Like, oh, this is like a well thought out sort of thing by the people running the casino. So to answer your question, I don't know if it was so much about Red's character as him just sort of having to deal with what was thrown at him initially, you know, if that makes sense. You know,
okay.
More so about like the structure of the casino for that part. I think like when you get into some of the more life-threatening gambling, then that's more about the stuff that he's dealing with.
So basically the ratio has more to do with just going from entry level, getting his soul crushed to the full-on violence. So the gross was the demoralizing entry table and the violent was the basically where they wanted to get him to be so he could get to that end stage, that climax where he had to go to the extreme to make the real money.
Right. Yeah.
Gotcha. Well, Red got the nickname Red because he had a port wine stain on his neck, which is a birthmark in which swollen blood vessels create a reddish purplish discoloration of the skin. Was there any symbolism behind giving him this very specific birthmark? And if so, what was it?
I think for him, there's a couple things that are like metaphorical with it. It's tough. I don't really want to necessarily give it away because some of it is alluded to in the book. But I will say like one of the purposes of it as well was that we needed Red to stand out. You know what I mean? In a very ghastly crowd, how does somebody stand out? How does the casino manager, when she sees all kinds of fucked up shit all the time, how do we get somebody to stand out? You know what I mean? And I think that's definitely one way. Now, the casino manager, sure, like at first, he's just standing out. You know what I mean? But then she realizes there's something more to Red that she sort of relates to herself and takes an interest in him. But the port wine stain is certainly like a tipping point for that. And plus, I got to write all kinds of awesome jokes when gangsters talk shit to him and be like, hey, period, bitch, shut the fuck up. So, I mean, who doesn't want that, you know?
Yeah. Definitely plenty of opportunities for comedy with that one.
Yeah, I think it's fun to give a character a nice distinct trait, you know, and it's like, I feel like people really know Red and can picture him because of his character, but also because of some of those physical traits. And I think if you have a couple things in there like that too, it can also make the reader feel more connected to a character, which is always what you're hoping for, you know?
Yeah, and you also have the association with gambling, betting on Red.
Of course, yep. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, one thing that seemed to be the cause of Red's miserable life was bad decisions. He ran with the wrong crowd and was forced into pulling a job that enslaved him to a mob boss. Then he misappropriated the mob boss's money, and now he finds himself in Shadow's casino. So this may be something that might be covered in the black version. So, you know, let me know if that's where the question needs to be redirected. But
sure.
The question I had was, what event or element in his life served as the catalyst for this domino effect of misery?
Oh, for Red's?
Yeah.
For Red's trajectory?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think it's probably like, and again, it's not something that's shown, but more alluded to. And I think it's the murder of his father. That kind of puts him on this path because he's always thinking about, damn, I don't want to become dad. You know what I mean? He wears his father's watch, not because he had like a strong connection with him, but because he didn't, you know? And most of what Red knows about his dad is what he's heard. And so because that watch touched his father's flesh and he wears it almost as a reminder to not become him, though, in a weird way, you know? It's like he loves him, but he also doesn't want to become him, you know? So, yeah, I think the event that's the catalyst is the murder of his father, because that is what puts you, I'm not going to say you, I'm saying like, that is what can potentially put a person down the wrong path, you know, not having that support.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we talked about this in the interview when we were talking about Playground, the lack of support. Yeah. Well, the owner of the club, which we have talked about many times within the podcast, mysteriously known as the Black Widow, is savage and heartless. However, due to her amazing backstory, I can't bring myself to do anything but admire her. And that's just from what I know that's revealed about her backstory in the Red version. I've definitely got to check out the Black version. Have you received feedback from your readers expressing conflicting feelings about the Black Widow? And if so, are there any you could reveal to us?
You know, I haven't really received feedback on her so much, but I will tell you that if you were interested by sort of the tidbits, in my book, she's kind of mysterious, you know, but there are like tidbits and morsels given, sort of rumor and innuendo that is shared amongst people in the casino as she comes around and they scurry about and they're like, oh shit.
Yeah.
You know, they're all scared and stuff. So yeah, if you enjoyed like those tidbits, like you really get to see how it all happened, even going back to her childhood in the Black version. So yeah, so I'd say you could see pretty much everything there, but I didn't really have, you know, part of it though, is I don't read a ton of reviews either. So that could be why, you know.
Yeah, the description you gave of her, I'm just envisioning this hot fitness model wearing a gothic dress. Well, one of the many horrific aspects of playing the games in the casino is the time constraints. You only have a specific amount of time to make a decision or complete a task before the consequences become definitive. The scarcity of time to think often causes people to make tragic mistakes. So how did you come up with the particular method of countdown and consequences for running out the clock relative to the particular game?
I think it's important because you want to keep the tension high. You don't want somebody to be able to sit there and hold a bowl of shit and slowly eat it. You know, it needs to be done or whatever's going to happen. And also, that's just the nature of casinos.
Yeah.
They're not there to let you sit down and have a drink and casually play hands. You need to keep going. At the end of the day, it's a business. While this one is a much more depraved business than any other that we've seen, it's still a business at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons, I mean, besides my own history of addiction, one of the reasons I don't gamble anymore is because you just couldn't freaking relax. Like, you were always under the gun to do something, and the players were just like bitching about every play. You know, I'm referring to poker, just bitching about every play you made and how you played it. It's like, dude, guys, just relax. This is 3-6-12. This isn't like 5-10 no limit or something, you know? We're playing with dollars here. Calm down.
Dude, I hear you on that too, because like, especially like what you said about it taking the fun out, I had a bookie for a little while. And a parlay is a big thing that goes wrong in Red's life in this book. And I used to do a lot of parlays and stuff like that. And talk about, you know, watching football, and it's like, I loved it. And then when you have money riding on a game, it just completely takes the fun out of it. A game that you would have thought was highly entertaining suddenly sucks just because, you know, your team didn't score enough points or the team you bet on, you know?
Yeah. Yep. Well, probably my favorite character, which you've mentioned already, was the bald man, which you confirmed my question that he does not have a name. He's just referred to as the bald man because I thought maybe I missed his name somehow. But he seemed to have a pleasant disposition. He was just an insane adrenaline junkie who thought he was 10 foot tall and bulletproof, probably because of the amount of pharmaceuticals he imbibed. But besides imparting a little wisdom to Red regarding the casino, what did you want his character to add to the story?
Well, I think, like, if Red just walked into this casino and it was just a bunch of people and we didn't get to know any of them and it was just all about Red, that would kind of suck to me, you know? So it's like the fact that he meets the bald man, the fact that he meets Lily, Mr. Don, you know, the Black Widow, Elaine, you know, like there's all these different characters that he kind of comes across at different times. And I think that that's interesting to learn, even if we don't focus on them for a ton of time, to learn a little bit about them, like what's their quirks. And with the bald man, it's like there's something really weird about him and we don't know what it is really. And it almost feels like he's kind of like chasing Red in a way. Mm-hmm. And I like that. It's like almost like uncertainty is chasing him. And what's in front of him is uncertain, but also what's behind him chasing him down. So I think it creates more questions for the reader and stuff. And that's why I kind of enjoyed it. And I liked, you know, the superstitious sort of luck type of person, you know. I used to do that. I mean, I'd be like, oh, shit, I'm going to keep sitting in the same spot because, like, my team wins when I sit in the spot, you know. Dumb shit like that. So I think that element is funny in gambling or just rooting for anything, kind of, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess collectively, the bald man, Mr. Don, and I think there was, I forget which game it was, but a dealer at one of the games, they collectively kind of were like the, if you think of the hero's journey archetype, they're like collectively the sage, you know, that character, yeah, kind of gets wisdom imparted from. Yeah.
Right. And that's true. I guess that's a good point to bring up, too. It's like the bald man has one approach to the casino that seems to be working. Mr. Don has another approach to the casino that seems to be working. Lily sort of imparts her own ideas about how he might be helped. And like you said, there's a dealer that does that for Red as well. But then Red has his own set of check marks he's got to hit. You know, he's got to do this in a certain amount of time. Like, can he take Mr. Don's attitude? Or maybe he can't because he doesn't have enough time. You know what I mean? So it's like he's kind of trying to work through all that stuff in his own head and see what makes the most sense, I guess, you know?
Yeah, because he's not only on the clock from the games and the casino, he's on the clock from what he's got, you know, working on the outside going against him. So, yeah.
Exactly. He's constantly reminded that his mother, you know, his frail old mother is in the hands of two violent, disturbed criminals that are like, you've got to be back here in 4 days. And, you know, it takes about a day to get there. So he doesn't have a lot of time.
Yeah. Yes. Well, Red finally meets the Black Widow and finds that her opinion of existence is that it operates indifferently and we are at the mercy of fate or luck. She's not without sympathy in that regard, so she gives Red a chance to get out of his horrific situation, which results in the reader getting to choose between two endings, the Red ending and the Black ending. So which ending do you prefer? And if you can tell us without giving the ending away, why?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I know you use the word choose, and that's true. The reader can choose, but we do prefer the reader gambles.
Ah.
That's a big part of the book. It's when you get to that juncture in the book, we do break the fourth wall. It's not talking about Red anymore. It's me talking to you, and it's me asking you to go find a coin. Or if you went to my website, abhorror.com, the limited hardbacks have the Shadows Casino Chip. There's two different versions of it. And when you flip that, if you're doing like a quarter, you designate either heads or tails as red or black.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're using the chip, it's already preset. But yeah, I wanted people to be an active participant and make this reading experience a little bit different. So like all that tension and everything that's built up to that point, it's on you. And if the ending comes out shit, it's on you. I think my favorite ending is probably the red ending, though. And I can vaguely answer the second part of your question, just meaning that because of what it means in the grand scheme of things, you know, mm-hmm. in life. And I think if people read the red ending, and it's all about that last sentence, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I wanted to comment on my own preference, but I don't know how I would do that without spoiling something. So I kind of prefer the black ending. I'll tell you why off when we're not recording, but there's some poetry to that ending. I really dig it.
Well, I'm glad you said that, but I think it's weird because like they're kind of saying they both have a message.
Mm-hmm.
One is just happier, I think, though. You know?
Yeah.
But yeah, they both definitely got a message.
I mean, I definitely don't enjoy the beginning part of that ending, but the ending of that ending, if that makes sense. I think there's,
right.
It's very poetic. I really like that.
You'd be a very sick person if you enjoyed the beginning of that.
Yeah. No, the beginning was not, yeah. That's, I mean, that was classic Beauregard depravity, but I enjoyed it on that front. But yeah, definitely not like, oh, I'm happy this is happening. Well, as always, the book is peppered with perfectly placed illustrations courtesy of Anton Razovsky. And has he done all the artwork for your books?
Almost all of them, yeah. I think there's like just a couple, like Nightmare Nirvana, Zach Dunn did that one, but almost everything Anton has done. I love working with him.
Well, is the particular artistic aesthetic that he has, is that his signature style or is it exclusive to your books?
You know, it kind of depends, I think. Like if you look at a cover like Yellow, because I'll have to like describe, you know, I write a few pages usually of like what I'm sort of envisioning. And then he almost always just nails it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, sometimes if you look at a book like Hallucinations, I wanted that to be almost like these depraved mushroom, because that was about bad trips, like bad mushroom trips that I had been on kind of, and like thoughts that came out of those.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted almost like the aesthetic of like the old Mickey Mouse, you know, like those old Mickey Mouse cartoons and stuff.
Uh-huh.
With these mushroom men. So that cover looks really different. If you looked at it, some people might even be like, that doesn't even look like the same artist.
Okay.
And the cover of Yellow, that one looks like a pulp crime novel cover.
Giallo.
Yeah. So again, it doesn't even look like him. So I think, so I guess the answer is no, that like he has like different styles depending on what it calls for, what the job calls for.
Like, I can't remember, I'm trying to think of the artwork in All Smiles Until I Return, but I would say that the same artistic aesthetic he has in this book was the same in The Cuck.
Mm.
I guess that's the reason I was asking.
For interiors, I think he's pretty consistent, you know?
Oh, like, yeah, that's what I meant, is the interior illustrations, yeah.
Right, I was more talking about the covers, but for the interior illustrations, it's consistent. Type of style, yeah.
Well, it is a hell of a book, and I highly recommend it. And along with the red version, as you've mentioned, there is a black version written by Daniel Volpe, which I now understand is from the Black Widow's point of view. Will there be any other versions? And what inspired the concept for this collaboration?
It's something that me and Dan had talked about after we wrote this other book, So Sorry. Initially, we were going to do something else that was like that, where like I wrote the first half And then like he wrote the second half and the story's kind of interconnected a little bit, you know, at different points. And we were like, what would that be like if we did that for a full book? You know what I mean? And just did separate books. The tricky thing about this, though, is I wanted to make sure that the book stood on its own, but also complemented each other's books. You know what I mean? Like, I didn't want anyone to feel obligated to have to buy both of them. Like, you can buy the red version and read the red version and never read anything else. And you should feel, you should walk away from that and feel very good about it. And, you know, not have any questions or major questions, I should say. But there are like very little, like small subtleties within the book that, like, for example, in my book, when he's walking through the casino on the main floor, he's seen so much depravity that when he sees a sign for this place called Underground Alley, and he's just like, fuck, I can't do any more right now. I need to go get a drink or something. In Dan's book, like, you get to see what's in Underground Alley. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
So it's like, it's not like that is like a huge blow where the reader would be like, well, what the fuck? It's more or less just a sign that he looked at and he never went over there. You know what I mean? So it is a very tricky balance, though, to make sure you're kind of giving somebody a full story while also tying into something else. So, yeah, I think it took about a year and a half to like finish and everything.
So did one person write first and the other built off of it, or?
Initially, we took a writer's retreat in New York to a cabin for several days, and we both wrote about 30,000 words. Which at that time we thought that was going to be the stories. But as I reevaluated mine, I said, there's not enough character here. Like Red's character arc, it wasn't there. You know what I mean? It was more just like a guy in a casino, supposed to be like a short thing kind of. And I felt there wasn't enough meaning. And so from there, they evolved into novels. So yeah, went from 30,000 words to mine ended up being 75,000. So I actually wrote more after the writer's retreat. And then, of course, the exhaustive process of we had to edit each other's books to make sure everything was aligning with the other one's shit.
Oh, okay. So that's where it took place, was the editing.
That was where we kind of double-checked everything. But, I mean, we had a lot of the initial conversations at the cabin, but then we would have to do, like, phone calls and stuff after. And then we had to get another editor to read both of them back-to-back to get an unbiased opinion and make sure that everything kind of connected and interwove properly. So very complicated process.
Wow.
And it took an extremely long time to do because we also had to release both the books at the same time. So we had to kind of like wait for each other, you know, it's not like, so yeah.
Wow. So that's the first time I've heard anybody that I've interviewed talk about a writer's retreat. Do you do that often?
I just did another one in Austin, Texas with Christopher Triana, Rath James White, Shane McKenzie, Judith Sonnet, Lucas Mangum. We were in a lake house. I think it was 4 days. And the next project that I'm working on is a collaboration with Shane McKenzie called Benjamin. And it's about this $100 bill that travels through the hands of several criminals. You're kind of like following this $100 bill through this grimy city. And so, yeah, this is another one that is like, we were writing it at the same time while we were together, which is great because it's so fucking intricate that we literally had to take it apart and put it back together. I'm not even joking. Like, we must've done it 100 times. Like,
wow.
There was one night where we were talking like 6-7 hours. You know what I mean? Like, and we just having to keep talking through stuff and like, they call it killing your darling in writing.
Yeah.
Where you have this really fucking cool idea, but it doesn't make any sense. And you're like, oh, how can we make it make sense? And sometimes you just got to kill it. You know, you just got to let it go. And we had to do that a few times with this story, but holy shit, man, is it so much fucking better now because we let go of that and found what it actually needed. Yeah. So to answer your question, writer's retreats, I've only done 2, but I've yielded large word counts from both. And I really like it, you know, because you get to sort of talk with other writers, share ideas, listen to stories, you know, like Rath James White, I mean, he's been writing forever, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like really cool to listen to him and all the stories that he had to tell.
You know, you talk about Kill Your Darlings. The film directors, screenwriters that I've interviewed, I always talk about, you know, I love auteurs like Gaspar Noé or Tarantino, the guys that write, direct, edit, do all that. And they're like, yeah, it's cool, but it's really hard to pull off. The reason that it's usually best for a director and an editor to be separate is because the director will bust their ass to get that one perfect shot. So he's not going to let go of it, you know?
Right.
The editor that's not tied to it will kill that darling.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's
got to be rough.
You got to kind of just kick each other's asses sometimes too with this, you know, be like, dude, we can't do this. And sometimes he'll be like, yeah, well, you can't do this, you know? So the secret is just to not get emotional. It's easy to get emotional about these stories that you put so much into and spend so much time on, but you also got to be a professional, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I was looking through your bibliography and I noticed a book called Wet Market, and it piqued my interest because I read that you only sell it on your website because it's too extreme. Can yeah. you tell me a little bit about that one? Because that might be on my TBR.
Yeah, that one is like, that was the first book I ever made like a website exclusive.
Uh-huh.
And there were just a couple things in it, a close... Put it this way, the person who edited the book didn't want to be named as the editor for the book.
No shit.
So I was like, all right, fuck it. I'll use that as the marketing then. You know what I mean? I'll be like, all right, it was edited by Anonymous. You know what I mean? Too obscene for Amazon.
It was ghost edited.
Yeah. So, and the person said, I don't think you should release this. I don't think... people are going to like this. I don't, you know what I mean?
Oh, shit.
And,
oh, that's awesome.
It became the highest grossing thing I've ever released on my website.
Wow. I mean, talk about the Streisand effect. Don't look at this. Stay away from it. It's horrible.
Yeah. I mean, that we're lucky with extreme horror is that that controversial element sells itself. It's just,
yeah.
People have to know, they're curious. And
yeah,
the thing with Wet Market is like, it's a very personal story too, that one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I just finished watching my dad die, unfortunately.
Sorry to hear that.
Like, that's okay. It's going to happen to all of us, I guess. But
mm-hmm.
It was pancreatic stage 4 cancer. So it was very emotional, obviously, going through something like that. So sort of tying the desperation that I was feeling in my own life into the story. And, you know, then there's the anger elements of everything that's going on. So that is definitely taken out in there as well. And I don't like people telling me what to do. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to read my stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody has to read anything. So it's like, there's a lot of people that feel like they should be able to control you and what you do just because they disagree with it or it offends them.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to give them an extra special fuck you at this one. You know?
Nice. Well, kind of in the vein of what we've been talking about, extreme horror seems to be gaining a firm foothold in the indie writing community. So do you think that as extreme horror becomes more popular, it will bleed out, if you'll pardon the expression, into mainstream publishing?
I think it can, particularly because society is sort of like a pendulum swing, sort of, you know, and like right now I feel like we're into this like super sensitive, like you got to fucking walk on eggshells all the time, da 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 da, mm-hmm. right? Like everybody's fucking evil if they fart or they say the wrong thing. Like, you know, yeah. we're going to cancel you and you're never going to see the light of day. We're going to ruin your career. That is a loud minority that acts like that. And there's going to be a point where everyone else speaks up and just finally says, shut the fuck up. And it's going to swing the other way. And at that point, that's when you might see some of this stuff getting more of a push.
Yeah.
Particularly with like streaming and stuff like that now too. You have places like Shudder and Screambox. There's even a couple others too, but Yeah, so I think there's certainly more opportunity for it. I mean, you see a movie like The Sadness get major success. That's essentially extreme horror, you know? So, and I've gotten onto quite a lot of bookshelves too. I don't even know how sometimes, because there's a demand for it. So the people will decide. If that's what they want, it'll be there.
Yeah, The Sadness. I don't think I've ever watched a movie go from zero to holy fuck so quick in my life.
Dude, that one's nuts. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah. Actually, my wife and I watched a movie. It's from 2022, but it just got released on Shudder, Megalomaniac. Have you seen that?
I have not.
It's French extremist, so it's subtitled, but man, is it fucking good. I love the French. Good.
I got to see it.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Because I love, like, Inside, you know, Martyrs, all that.
Martyrs. Mm.
So, High Tension, right?
Oh, yeah.
Another good one.
That used to be a stock question that I asked on my podcast towards the end was, what do you think of the movie Martyrs?
Oh, yeah. You might have asked me that the first time. You might have asked me that.
Yeah, I think I did. Yeah.
Because I'm a big fan of that French extreme wave that happened in like the, you know, like 2008 kind of era over there. Mm-hmm. There was so much good stuff.
Yeah.
Just something about how those films looked. It was different, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. So I was curious, since you are a full-time writer, what does a full-time writing schedule look like?
Well, it's probably less writing than what people would think, because there's so much other shit you have to do. Well, for me anyway, I don't know if it would be the same for someone who is traditionally published, let's say. But a lot of people who are traditionally published still aren't writing for a living, because it's still incredibly hard to do. Hmm. Anybody who's listening to this, if you have a passion for writing, independently publishing your shit, owning all your IP, creating multiple revenue streams, you know, have yourself Audible revenue, have yourself Amazon revenue, have yourself a store. It's all those streams that's what's going to stabilize you. Because if one goes down, hopefully the other goes up. And the more content that you release, the more stability that you'll have. And that way, when you get one book that hits, your back catalog will hopefully continue to thrive. But what does it look like exactly? One day I could be editing all day. Usually every couple days I have to print out a bunch of labels, pack a bunch of signed books, because I do a lot of merchandising. I mean, the room I'm in right now, there's four bookshelves completely filled with hardcovers, paperbacks. I have like keychains, magnets, stickers. I'm talking like thousands of all these items in this room. So that is
this is your warehouse.
Yeah, I have a store in my house. So that's a full-time job in itself. But yeah, and then the social media element of it too, which that's probably the most exhausting thing in my opinion. But you have to be out there. You have to stay relevant. You can't just be creative on the page. You've got to show it to the readers. You've got to acknowledge them and be grateful for them. You've got to maintain your relevance. That is the biggest thing. But if you could do that, I'm not saying you learn all that right away, but over time you learn these things and you put it all together and it's doable, but you have to fucking really, really want it.
Nice. I think I just found the sound bite for the show.
Oh, nice.
How has your writing process evolved over time?
I'm always learning stuff with that, you know. I think just continuing to be open to learning has done a lot for me. Some of my greatest evolution is letting people shit on my work. Even if you don't agree with what they're saying, that hard contrast of opinion, it will really make you think, you know. And there's plenty of times when they are saying the right thing too, of course. So I think just integrating with the horror community and finding new people to push you and challenge you, like Christopher Triana did that a lot for me too, which really helped me out, you know. When we started working together with the obituaries business that we have with Daniel J. Volpe, you know, we edit each other's stories. And Chris has been writing a long time. I believe he's been active for like 10 years in writing, where I'm closer to like six or something like that, or five. And yeah, just having that veteran presence to push you and challenge your ideas, it makes you a better writer for sure. But also just thinking more about character, you know, and this was a natural sort of thing that I dawned on my own, thankfully. But I think it's super important. It's like, what is your character's metamorphosis? Like, what is their evolution? What is the reader going to witness that changes about them, you know? So a lot of stuff can rely on plot, and plot is great. You know, you need a good plot too. But more than that, you definitely have to have the relatable characters. And I don't know, I just think that that has taken my work to the next level, is just really continuing to get better at developing characters.
Gotcha. Well, tell me about these live TikTok sessions that you've been doing with authors, because I am still living in the dark ages and don't have TikTok, so I haven't seen any of them. But I've seen a mention of them on your Instagram page.
Yeah, so when Playground went viral, I was pretty fortunate. I got a pretty good following on TikTok. I think I'm almost like at 29,000 followers or something now. But
nice.
The numbers can sometimes be misleading too, because it's like, oh yeah, you might have that many followers, but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's your true reach. Either way, though, I like to try to prop other people up if I can, you know, like if maybe, you know, I have something that could potentially get some reach, why not share that with other great people? Like Rath James White was the first person I wanted to do it with. He's been writing for so long. I just have an incredible amount of respect for not only his work, but what he's done for the extreme horror splatterpunk genre, you know, and sort of being a father figure for it. And his work's just incredible too. So having that conversation, being able to talk to him about Killer Con and the Splatterpunk Awards, which for anyone who does enjoy extreme horror in Austin, Texas, Killer Con is where the Splatterpunk Awards are held. It's a great event, almost like a family reunion of sorts. If you look at a network, or if you're looking to see some interesting panels, readings, and events, Killer Con in Austin, Texas, for sure. So yeah, Rath was one person. And then I also talked and did a live with C.V. Hunt. And C.V. Hunt is the owner of Grindhouse Press, which they kind of publish a lot of extreme horror, bizarro, maybe like trash and like exploitation sort of literature. Mm-hmm. And in my opinion, Grindhouse Press is one of the premier indie publishers, even though I publish my own stuff. C.V. Hunt has helped me with like cover reps. C.V. Hunt's helped us with some of the stuff for the obituaries as well. And the way they approach publishing is from an author's perspective. They're not out there to fuck people. You know, so many of these publishers that come and go, they're not giving authors their fair due. Grindhouse is the exact opposite of that. And I just have so much respect for that publisher in general, even though I don't use publishers. You know what I mean? That doesn't mean I can't come out and say, like, listen, if you do want to use a publisher, that'd be the one that you should use, because they respect people more than they have to. They go above and beyond. So it was great to talk to Carrie on the live there, kind of about the history of Grindhouse and some of the upcoming releases that they're doing. And I haven't been able to do another live yet in a little while, just because I've been so damn busy, but I am planning on going back and doing some more stuff. But yeah, that's pretty much what it's about. It's just like, let's shine a light on these people. I want to tell people why I respect these people and things that they've done, if they're not already aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I saw the TikTok video that went viral, because I remember, I don't know if you remember me reaching out to you. I just, all of a sudden, one day, my downloads started blowing the fuck up. I mean, I was getting hundreds and hundreds a day. And so I looked at the stats and saw the majority of them were your episode that you did with Playground. So I reached out. I was like, dude, did you like, what happened? And you said, I think it was that TikTok where a woman was talking about, I bet you can't make it to page whatever in right. Playground. Was that what it was?
Yeah. Jiggy Saw Girl. She's a TikToker and she's a Saw super fan. And mm-hmm. she got her hands on the Playground book and did a video about it. And yeah, 23 million views. It ended up pushing Playground to number one in horror on Amazon. So
wow.
it was pretty incredible. I can't thank her enough. And she did do another video recently for me. So thank you, Bailey. And everyone should follow Jigsaw Girl on TikTok. Not because she's doing my content, but most of her content is movie-related stuff. She does some literature, but her videos are just awesome. There's a reason that they put her in Saw X. And that she has a part in that movie. And she is also interviewing. She's done interviews with the directors and the writers. So the franchise also respects her and what she does.
Awesome. Well, do you currently have any of your work optioned for film or TV? Because I remember at one point The Cuck was optioned, but didn't COVID put the kibosh on that?
It did, yeah. I didn't end up getting to do anything with that. I do have one active option right now, but with that stuff, you never know. You know,
yeah.
You could feel like it's going to happen any day, and then it's 2 years later. And that's why anybody who is writing and has any experience with this knows never hold your breath with any of that stuff. But yeah, it sucks too initially when you find out, because most people aren't familiar with, like, you know, if you're starting out as a writer and people start reaching out to you, you're going to get really excited. Mm-hmm. But it's a good thing to like temper that excitement, because, you know, probably like 95% of the time it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. I forget who it was that told me there's an expression in Hollywood that says movies don't get made.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, how many novels have you written so far? And have you noticed a recurring theme that seems more prevalent than others?
I got to be close to like 30 books, not novels, but like releases. I've probably had close to 30 releases at this point.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as prevalent themes, I think maybe not, because the more I think about it, looking at each of the books on my shelves, some of them, they're just completely different. Like Pizza Face, a collection about mutation, you know, Modern Hysteria is about children and technology and how that can be a very dangerous thing. Hallucinations is drug horror. Yellow is like pulp crime fiction mixed with horror. Morbid Curiosities is almost like the Twilight Zone if it was more extreme. Scary Bastards, a slasher. Honestly, like, it's a wide range. And I think that's good to kind of not keep falling into the same thing, you know? Because you never know. And I'm not saying like I would ever leave horror. That's all I care to write, pretty much. You know, there will always be some elements of horror in my writing, but there's different flavors of it too, you know, and it's good to stretch your legs because you may surprise yourself.
Yeah. Well, I have got to compliment you on your website. It is amazing. And I was curious to know which item or items sell the best and why do you think that is?
Well, the all-time bestseller is Wet Market. And I think that might be because it's an exclusive. You know, that's the only place that you can get Wet Market. Also, in second place was Playground. But Through the Eyes of Desperation is like right there with it. And that's only been out and available maybe like a month and a half. The pre-order was up. So that one is quickly becoming the top one. And I think it's because I did a lot of different stuff with that. Like I had cards printed that have all the artwork from both of the Through the Eyes of Desperation books, like the kings and the queens, they all have artwork from the book and my cover on the back and stuff. So yeah, you get like a deck of playing cards with that one. You get the custom poker chip, all different kinds of stickers and swag, magnets, keychains. So yeah, I think that tends to sell the best. I do limited edition signed and numbered hardcovers. And those are only available when I drop an initial release. Like, for example, the Playground hardcovers, those sold out and they're gone. You know, the Wet Market hardcovers, those sold out and you're gone. You can still get signed paperbacks, but there's kind of something special to the initial run of the hardcovers, you know?
Well, is there anything you'd like to see more or less of in the literary world?
Well, in the literary world, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do you mean the world or in, like, writing? Just to clarify.
Well, I mean, I guess all encompassing, like whether it's from the actual content of the writing or maybe the way that it's produced, you know, would you like mainstream publishing to just go to hell and everything go indie or?
I mean, I think it's good to have both, you know, personally, mm-hmm. not to sound egotistical at all, but it's like if I was going to go with a big publisher, they'd have to give me a king's ransom. Not that I think they'd even want me or that I'd be able to sell. Like, this is just a hypothetical, to be clear, because I have everything under control that I need right now. You know, mm-hmm. I don't need anyone. And that's a great feeling, you know,
yeah.
when you don't need anyone and you're completely self-reliant. I used to be in a band. And that was something that always fucking pissed me off, is you got to depend on other people. And if their passion isn't equal to yours, or if their business acumen isn't equal, or if someone's a snake, that's all different shit you got to deal with. That's the beautiful thing about writing now in this day and age, right? You go back, talk to Rath James White when he was keying his shit up on a word processor, or Ronald Kelly when he was mailing in manuscripts, you know what I mean? Off his typewriter. And it's like, these fucking guys, it was more about someone believing in you. Now, all you got to do is believe in yourself. And even if you don't make it, my whole thing was like, I just want to fill up a shelf with like shit that I think is cool. That was the only goal I ever entered writing with. Everything else that came after that, the success, the awards, I won the Splatterpunk Award twice. I've been able to live more comfortably than I ever could have imagined. And that is all gravy. You know, it's not anything that I ever expected. And as long as you have that type of expectation, you can never fail. That's what we need more of. People believing in themselves. If you can, that's the thing. It's a lot of work. But to take it all, take the reins yourself, right? Then you're not depending on somebody else and your success is in your own hands. And I'd much rather take that gamble than bet on someone else.
Mic drop. That's what I'm talking about. Well, Aaron, as always, it has been a pleasure talking with you.
Oh, thank you. No, thanks for having me. It's always great. Fan of the show. Glad that you're still doing it and going strong.
Yes, sir. Well, as we bring the show to a close, is there anything you'd like to plug or let your readers know about?
I'll just say if you guys want any like particulars about major announcements and stuff like that, my Substack's a great thing to subscribe to. It's free. You can support if you want to, but it's absolutely free. It'll disseminate an email to you when I have like a major announcement or if I have like a sale in my store. I don't tend to inundate people with those though. It's usually a once tops twice a month kind of thing. And that's at aaron.beauregard.substack.com. So if you just Google Aaron Beauregard Substack, that'll come up and you can subscribe for free. My website is abhorror.com. And that's where you can find all my merch, swag. I've got some really gnarly t-shirts as well. I get them printed in small batches to make sure that the quality is good. And I'm going to be dropping another really messed up one soon. This one's super messed up. I call it early retirement. So,
all right.
Also, like, I don't release shirts just to release a shirt because it looks cool. Like, I actually, like, build a story with the shirt. There's, like, a reason I'm releasing each item. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay.
So it's a little bit different. Some people release merch, and it looks cool, and that's great. But I also, like, put a story, and it's, like, something of myself and what represents the brand. There's, like, a reason for it. So you can check that out on my Substack if you're interested.
Awesome. All right, listeners at home, all links are in the description. And Aaron, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
And thank you to everyone that tuned in. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to like, share, and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday when I will once again be joined by another one of the Splatterpunk greats. So until then, stay healthy, stay sane, and as always, thank you for listening. See you next time.
can take. Wait until the sun goes down, that's when I can let it out. You can call me crazy, I call it fate. Transformation taking over me.
Face. From dusk till dawn.